I want to continue in volume 4, and this is October the 15th, 1900. This is a trial of obedience for Louisa. So I want to give you 1 Samuel 15, verses 22 to 24, that obedience is better than sacrifice. And I want to give you Deuteronomy 28, the blessings that come from obedience. Louisa said, "This morning after I received communion, blessed Jesus let me hear his voice saying, 'My daughter, this morning I feel all the necessity to be refreshed. Please take my pains upon yourself a little bit and let me take some rest in your heart.' Louisa said, 'Yes, my good, let me feel your pains, and while I suffer in your place, you will have all the ease to be able to refresh yourself and to take some sweet rest. I only ask of you to wait a little longer until I remain alone, so that nobody may see me suffer, because it seems to me that the confessor is still here.' And Jesus said, 'What does it matter if the priest is present? Wouldn't it be better if instead of one, I had two refreshing me? That is, you suffering and he concurring with me with the same intention.' At that moment, Louisa said, 'I saw the confessor placing the intention of crucifixion, and immediately, without the slightest hesitation, the Lord shared with me the pains of the cross. Then, after I was in those sufferings for a little while, the confessor called me to obedience. Jesus withdrew, and I tried to submit to the one who commanded me. But when, in one instant, my sweet Jesus came back again, wanting to subject me to the pains of the crucifixion a second time, the priest did not want it. When I would conform to Jesus, that is, to suffering, Jesus would come. When the priest would see that I would begin to suffer, he would stop the suffering with the obedience. So here you have a struggle between Jesus and the authority of the church, or the authority of the church with the will of God. And so when the priest would stop it, Jesus would withdraw. I would suffer a great pain indeed on seeing Jesus withdraw, but I would do as much as I could to obey. And at times, seeing the confessor present, I would let them deal with it, waiting to see who would win, whether obedience or our Lord. I seemed to see obedience and Jesus actually fighting, both powerful and both capable of facing a fight. After they fought well, as I tried to see who was winning, the Queen Mother came, who, drawing near the priest, said, 'My son, this morning, in which Jesus himself wants her to suffer, would you let him do it? Otherwise, nobody will be spared the chastisement, not even in part.'" Because when Louisa prays and suffers, then the chastisements are reduced, sometimes by one third, which is absolutely amazing. At that moment, it was as if the priest was distracted in going on with the fight, and Jesus, the winner, subjected me to the pains again, but with such vehemence and bitter spasms that I myself do not know how I remained alive. When I thought I was dying, obedience called me again, and I just barely found myself inside myself. That's back to normal. Blessed Jesus, being refreshed but not yet content, upon coming back, wanted to repeat the crucifixion for the third time. However, arming herself with strength, this time obedience won and my beloved Jesus was defeated. In spite of this, every now and then he would try. Who knows, he might win again. So much so that he gave me no respite, and I had to say, "But my Lord, keep still a little bit and leave me alone. Don't you see that obedience has armed herself and will not yield to you? So have patience." Imagine asking God to have patience. I think that's fascinating. "Have patience. And if you want to repeat it the third time, promise me that you will let me die." And Jesus said, "Yes, come." So I told this to the priest also, And in this obedience, he was inexorable, even though my sweet good was calling me, saying, Louisa, come. I said he was calling me, but the answer was a curt no from the priest. What a nice obedience this is, she said, since she wants to act in everything and over everything like a proper signora. She wants to meddle in things which don't belong to her, like dying. Besides, how nice. Exposing a poor, unhappy creature to the dangers of dying, let her touch the harbour of eternal happiness with her own hand, and then to show that she can act like a proper madam in everything. By dint of the strength she possesses, she holds her back and makes her lie in the miserable, she holds Louisa back and makes her lie down in the miserable prison of their body. And if one asks, why is all this happening? First, she won't answer. And then in her mute language, she tells you, why? Because I am a signora and I have power over everything. It seems as if one wants to be at peace with this blessed obedience. It takes the patience of a saint. Not only that, but the patience of our Lord himself. In other words, true heroism. Otherwise, one would be in continuous frictions with her, because this is about wanting to touch the extremes. You see how the saints are tested. I mean, the rest of us would go mad. So, seeing that he could not win, and the Blessed Lord calmed down at the obedience and he left me alone. He mitigated the pains I was suffering and said to me, my beloved, in the pains you have suffered, I wanted to have you experience the fury of my justice by pouring it out on you a little bit. Now, the fury of his justice in 1900 is that this is when communism absolutely bursts upon the world with its totally destructive effect to make the 20th century what Jesus himself calls the most evil century of all. So, Jesus said to her, if you could see with clarity what point human beings have made justice reach and how the fury of my justice has armed itself against them, you would tremble like a leaf and you would do nothing but pray me to pour the pains upon yourself. And then he seemed to sustain me in my sufferings and to cheer me. And he said, I feel better, don't you? And Louisa said, well, ah, Lord, who can tell what I feel? It seems to me that I have been crushed inside of a machine. Now, for that, I want to give you Lamentations 1:14b, the second half of the verse, verse 20a and verse 15, Lamentations chapter 1. Who knows about my sorrow, it talks about. And Jesus said, oh, Louisa said, I've been crushed inside of a machine. I feel such exhaustion that if you don't infuse vigour into me, I cannot come round. And Jesus said, my beloved, it is necessary that you feel the pains with intensity at least once in a while. And the amazing thing is that he says, first for yourself, because as good as a piece of iron may be, if it is left a long time without putting it in the fire, it always comes in contact with a little bit of dust, of rust. Second, for me, because if I did not unload myself on you for a long time, my fury would become so ignited that I would have no regard for the world. In other words, he would end it all, nor would I spare it in the least. And if you did not take my pains upon yourself, how could I maintain my word of sparing the world chastisements, at least in part? Because that's the gift that's given to the victim soul. After this, the confessor came to call me to obedience and I returned inside of myself. October the 17th, 1900. I have a VIP on this one. A suffering soul and a most humble prayer make Jesus lose all strength and render him so weak as to let himself be bound by that soul. So here the message is the power that the victim soul has over the Lord because of the fact that she uses the passion of Jesus all the time. As my adorable Jesus continued to come, I seemed to see him in such great suffering as to arouse compassion. Throwing himself into my arms, he said to me, "My daughter, break the fury of my justice, otherwise..." And he didn't finish the sentence. At that moment, I seemed to see divine justice armed with swords, with darts of fire, so as to strike terror. And also the strength with which divine justice can act. All frightened, I said, "How can I break your fury if I see you so strong as to be able to annihilate heaven and earth in a simple instant?" He created the heavens and the earth in a simple instant. Of course, he can annihilate it as well. And Jesus said, "Yet a suffering soul and a most humble prayer make me lose all my strength and render me so weak as to let myself be bound by that soul as she pleases." And Louisa said, "Ah, Lord, in what an ugly appearance justice shows herself." And Jesus added, "Justice is not ugly, because justice is divine. How can anything divine be ugly? If you see her armed like this, it is because of human beings. It's because of humanity. But in herself, she's good and holy like my other attributes." Everything in God is holy, you see. "Because..." "There cannot even be a shadow of evil in me. It's true that her appearance seems harsh, piercing, bitter, but her fruits are sweet and delicious." And Matthew 7:25 says that by their fruits you will know them. If the fruits are good, then the tree is good. If the fruits are evil, the tree is evil. So, while justice may seem harsh to us, the fruits, and he will talk about the fruits of justice quite a bit in these writings. And we need to just realize, and he will talk about this also as we go along, that all the attributes of God are completely equal. Justice equals mercy. Justice and mercy equal wisdom. Justice, mercy and wisdom equal love. They're all the same. They're all infinite. They're all divine. So October the 20th, 1900. "Just as justice wants satisfaction for what is unjust, so does love want the outpouring of its love." In other words, justice and love are equal. Both of them are divine. "This morning on coming," Louisa said, "my adorable Jesus made me see his attributes and he said to me, 'My daughter, all of my attributes are in continuous attitude or relationship with humanity and all of them demand their tribute.'" And he added, "Just as justice wants satisfaction for what is unjust, so does my love want the outpouring of its loving and being loved. So I want you to place yourself inside of justice and pray and repair there. And when you receive some blow, have patience to bear it. But don't stay there. Move on into my love and give me the outpouring of love. Otherwise, I would remain defrauded in love. As for example, this time I feel all the necessity to pour out my constrained love as if I were not allowed to do it, and if I were not allowed to do it, I would languish and faint." As he was saying this, he began to kiss me, caress me, and make so many tendernesses of love that I have no words to manifest them. And he wanted me to requite him, saying, "Just as I feel the need to pour myself out with you in love, so do you have the need to pour yourself out for me, isn't it true?" And we poured ourselves out in love to each other. So what you're looking at here is Louisa has suffered incredibly for divine justice, and Jesus heals her with love. Love is the great healing of the human race. So October the 22nd, 1900, this is about discernment. "This morning I was all oppressed and with a fear that it might not be Jesus who operates in me, but the devil." Now, she goes through this time out of number in the first 12 chapter volumes of these writings. But in spite of this, I couldn't refrain from looking for him and for desiring him. However, as soon as he deigned to come, he told me, "What is it that gives one the assurance that the sun is rising, if not the light which puts to flight the darkness of the night and the heat that spreads within that light?" Now, he's trying to get her to discern his presence from the presence of evil. "If anyone said that the sun is risen, but in spite of this, the darkness of the night appeared even thicker and no heat could be felt, what would you say? It's not true that the sun has risen. It's a false claim, because the effects of the sun cannot be seen." This is terribly important. "Now, if the sight of me dispels darkness from you and shows you the light of the truth, making you feel the heat of my grace, why do you want to rack your brains that I am not the one who operates in you?" In other words, you have the proof. God is light, 1 John 1:5. Jesus is the light of the world, John 8:12. Matthew 7:20, you can tell them by their fruits. Okay. So after this, then, Louisa says, "I add this because obedience wants it, that the other day I was thinking, if the many chastisements about which I wrote in these books should really occur, who would have the heart to be the spectator of them? And Blessed Lord made me understand with clarity," this is very, very important, "that some of them will occur while I'm still on the earth." Now, Louisa died in 1947. So some of the stuff was going to happen during her lifetime. "Some after my death, and some will be spared in part." So I was a little relieved, thinking that I will not have to see them all. Okay. And you see, Amos 3, 7 or 8 says that the Lord never does anything without telling his prophets first. The Lord is continuously telling us about what will happen to the earth if we continue sinning, and what will happen when we repent. The whole Bible is full of that, and the whole history of the church is full of it as well. So Louisa continues, "Here is Lady Obedience," that means the priests representing the church, "made satisfied now after she had begun to frown at me and to send out laments and reprimands," in other words, unreasonable obedience. "It seems that this blessed young lady is in no way wants to adapt herself to the human reason. She does not want to get involved in any circumstance. On the contrary, it seems that she has no reason at all. She's quite a pain in the neck," which is fantastic to have Louisa say that. It just shows you that while the saints will obey and will live according to the challenges that the God has given them, they still feel like the rest of us, which I think is wonderful. But it's still quite a pain in the neck having to deal with someone who does not have reason. In order to get along a little, it's necessary to lose one's own reason, because the young lady keeps boasting, "I have no human reason, therefore I do not know how to adapt myself to the human way. My reason is divine. And for one who wants to live in peace with me, it's absolutely necessary that she lose hers in order to acquire mine." I want to give you Isaiah 55, verses 8 to 10. "My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. My ways are as different from yours as the heavens are from the earth." So Louisa said, "This is how well this young lady reasons." What can one say? It's better to keep silent, because in one way or another, she always wants to be right, and she glories in giving you all the wrong. So Louisa is letting us know very clearly how costly these obediences from the priest really are, and how much against her own will it is. And so you can see that through obedience, the Lord is conquering Louisa's will, so that he will be able to let the divine will take over. So October the 23rd, 1900, is about love. I've said many times that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. This morning after I received communion, my adorable Jesus made me see the confessor who was placing the intention of having me suffer the crucifixion. I felt my poor nature reluctant, not because I didn't want to suffer, but for other reasons that I can't describe here. But Jesus, as though lamenting about me, said to Father, she doesn't want to submit herself. I was moved at his lament. The priest renewed the command, and I submitted myself. So notice that you are always completely free. The Lord will never override your free will, ever, ever. He wants that when we get to heaven, it has been our own decision to go there. It's been our own decision to do God's will and to cooperate with him in everything. So Louisa said, after I suffered a little, since I saw that the priest was present, the Lord said, my beloved, here is the symbol of the Most Holy Trinity, myself, the priest, and you. From eternity, my love has never been alone, but always united in perfect and reciprocal union with the divine persons, because true love never remains alone, but produces other loves and delights in being loved back. That's Proverbs 8:31. The Lord delights to be with the children of men. So he delights in being loved back by the loves which he has produced. And if it is alone, either it is not of the nature of divine love, it's only apparent. If you knew how much I delight in and enjoy being able to continue that love in souls, which reigned from eternity and reigns still now in the Most Holy Trinity. That's John 15:9. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. And then he, at the end, he says, so you must love one another. You also have Jeremiah 31:3. I have loved you with an everlasting love, and I am constant in my affection for you. This is also why I say to you that I want the consensus of the intention of the priest united with me to be able to continue this love more perfectly, which is a symbol of the Most Holy Trinity. He wants everything in threes, and we'll hear much more about this as we go on in these writings. So October the 29th, 1900. Again, we're talking about love. There's a VIP on this one. The most essential and necessary thing in a soul is charity. Now, that's divine love, and it's agape in Greek. After going through a few days of privation and of silence, this morning, as Blessed Jesus came, I said, it shows that my state is no longer your will. And he said, yes, yes, rise and come into my arms, he said. At these words, I forgot about the painful state of the last few days, and I ran into his arms. And since I could see his side was open, I said, my beloved, you have not admitted me to drink from your side for some time. I pray you to admit me to it today. And Jesus said, my beloved, please drink as much as you like and satiate yourself. Who can say my contentment and what avidity I placed my mouth at to drink from the divine fount? Okay. After I drank my fill to the point of having no more room to contain even just one more drop, I detached myself, and Jesus said, have you satiated yourself? If you haven't, keep drinking. I don't mind. And Louisa said, satiated? No, because the more one drinks of this font, the more one's thirst increases. But since I am very limited, I'm incapable of taking more. So I want to give you Isaiah 55 verses 1 to 3, come and drink is the invitation there. John 7:37 to 39, if you truly believe in me, come and drink, and out of your own heart will flow fountains of living water. I want to give you 2 Corinthians 4 verses 10 to 11. So after this, I saw other people with Jesus, Louisa said. And he said, the most essential and necessary thing in the soul is charity. Now, it's 1 John 4, 7 to 17. God is love. And also 1 Corinthians 13, 13, the greatest of these is love. 1 Corinthians 14, 1, you must want love more than anything else. If there's no charity in the soul, it happens, it's the same as with those families or kingdoms that have no rulers. Everything's upset and the most beautiful things remain obscured. There's no harmony. Some want to do one thing, some another. The same happens in the soul in which divine love does not reign. Everything is in disorder, just like society is today. The most beautiful virtues do not harmonize among themselves. And this is why charity is always called the queen, because she rules and orders and disposes everything. Now, we're going to hear an awful lot more about that as we go on in these writings. October the 31st, 1900. This is about Blessed Mother. The Celestial Mother helps Louisa to disarm justice. Okay. As I was in my usual state, I felt myself outside of myself and I found the Queen Mother. As she saw me, she began to speak about justice and how justice is about to clash with all its fury against humanity. She said many things about this and I don't have the words to express them. In the meantime, I could see the whole of heaven filled with points of swords against the world. And then she added, my daughter, you have disarmed divine justice many times, contenting yourself with receiving its blows upon yourself. Now that you see that divine justice is at the summit of its fury, do not lose heart, but be courageous. With a heart full of holy fortitude. Now, this fortitude is the steel girders for your soul. Enter into this justice and disarm it. Do not be afraid of the swords, the fire, or anything else that you may encounter in order to obtain the intent. If you see yourself wounded, beaten, burned, rejected, don't draw back. Rather, let this be a spur for you to move on. See, so that you may do this, I myself have come to help you by bringing you a special garment. As your soul wears it, you will acquire courage and fortitude so that you will fear nothing. So having said this, from within her mantle, she pulled out a garment woven of gold, streaked with various colours, and she clothed my soul. Now, it seems to me, I can't prove it, but it seems to me that our Blessed Mother is clothing Louisa with her own virtues and her own merits. Then she gave me her son, telling me, and now, as a pledge of my love, I place my dearest son in your custody. See, it would make sense that with a loan of Blessed Mother's virtues and graces, that then she looks after Jesus himself. I place my dearest son in your custody that you may keep him, love him and content him in everything. Try to act in my stead. In other words, be a mother to him. Now, we've met this already in volume 2, that Jesus had asked Louisa to be another earthly mother for him. So here's Blessed Mother saying it to her, try and act in my stead, try and do what I would do, so that he finds all his contentment in you. The discontent that all the others will give him may not cause him so much pain. So the next long paragraph is about resignation to the divine will. You see, we're on a journey and we don't succeed in surrendering our wills very easily. It's a big struggle. You may think you've done it and then you discover you've been doing your own will for hours. So it's a struggle. It's a journey. And the very first stage of that major journey is true, deep, humble, loving resignation to the divine will. And that's what we're going to be talking about. Louisa said, who can say how happy and strengthened I was, clothed with that garment and with the loving pledge in my arms. That's the pledge of Blessed Mother. Greater happiness I could certainly not desire. Then the Queen Mother disappeared and I remained with my sweet Jesus. We went around the earth a little bit, and among the many encounters we met a soul who was a prey to despair. Having compassion for that soul, we drew near her, and Jesus wanted me to speak to her to make her understand the evil, that is the evil of suicide, that she was doing. Through a light, which is infused knowledge, which Jesus himself infused into me, I said to her, the most salutary and efficacious medicine in the saddest encounters of life is resignation. It's step one. By despairing, instead of taking the medicine, you are taking the poison with which to kill your soul. That's mortal sin. Don't you know that the most appropriate remedy for all evils, the main thing that renders us noble, divinizes us, makes us similar to our Lord, and has the power of converting the very bitterness into sweetness is resignation? So resignation is the thing that actually changes us. It doesn't change God, but it does change us. Jesus says it has the power of changing the very bitterness we're going through into sweetness. What was the life of Jesus upon earth if not continuing to do the will of the Father? Now, I'd have to give you a complete summary of John's Gospel for that, but I'm only going to give you John 14:31. I want the world to know that I love the Father, therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me. And while he was on earth, he was united with the Father in heaven. It is the same for a resigned soul. While living on the earth, her heart and her will are united with God in heaven. I want to give you Romans 8:28 there, that nothing can separate us from Christ, nothing at all. Except our own will, of course. Can there be anything more dear and desirable than this? Louisa asks. As though stirred, that soul began to calm herself, and Jesus and I together withdrew. In other words, once grace has been given, then it's up to the individual to take the grace and to act with it. May everything be for the glory of God. And we won't hear any more about that soul, of course. So November 2nd, 1900. Here we have that union with God is the source of happiness. Now, as we go on in these writings, we start with union with God being the source of happiness. The divine will is happiness. The divine will is the operating part of the Blessed Trinity, the source of all life, all happiness, all beatitude. So, November 2nd, 1900. This morning, Louisa said, I feel all oppressed and afflicted, with the addition that Blessed Jesus was not making himself seen. Then after much waiting, he came out from within my interior, because he's there all the time. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 3:16 for that. Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you. So he came out from within my interior, opening his heart to me. He placed me inside his heart, telling me, remain inside of me. Only there will you find true peace and true contentment. Psalm 131. Because nothing penetrates into me which does not belong to peace and contentment. Okay. Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. One who dwells in me does nothing but swim in the sea of all contentment. I want to give you John 14:20-21 and Philippians 4:7. The peace that passeth all understanding. While by going outside of me, even the soul, even if the soul did not bother about anything, at the mere sight of the offences they give me, that human beings give me, and how humanity grieves me, she already comes to participate in those afflictions and she remains troubled. In other words, we see Louisa still at this point in volume four, allowing herself to get upset by what she sees is going wrong in the world. She's got to be able to look at it, and she will come to that, to look at it peacefully and still do the reparation. So therefore, every once in a while, would you forget everything, enter into me and enjoy the peace and happiness. Now, we call that contemplative prayer, going into the depth of that silence. Then go out and do for me the office of my repairer. So having said this, he disappeared. November the 8th, 1900. This one is about obedience. Okay. And I just want to give you as an introduction. Once an order is given, the human rebellion will be shown up and must be dealt with. So obedience exposes our ego and destroys it. Let me give you an example. Many years ago, I used to do a bit of babysitting. And if the mother said on leaving the house, "Don't touch the biscuits," there was only one issue for the whole evening, and it was biscuits. But if the mother had said nothing, the rebellion wouldn't have been shown up. God said to Adam and Eve, "Don't touch that particular fruit in the Garden of Eden." It was the only thing they wanted to touch. And that is what actually illustrates the rebellion inside of us. And that's why obedience actually deals with that rebellion that is in the very warp and woof of our being. I mean, one of the things that you can see frequently on the roads in Ireland is people parking on double yellow lines. The double yellow line says this is the place where you don't park. But if people park there, they're saying, "I can park wherever I like." There's absolute rebellion to a law telling them that you may not do it there. I think the best thing I've ever seen was a car parked out on double yellow lines outside of a police station. So continuing with his usual delays, Louisa said, "I was feeling all the weight of his privation when all of a sudden Jesus came. I don't know why. He posed me this question. Would you be able to tell me why obedience is so glorified?" That's 1 Samuel 15, verses 20 to 24. "And receive such honour as to imprint the divine image on the soul," Romans 8, 21. All confused, I didn't know what to answer. Now, she's been through this terrible trial of obedience, and she doesn't know how to answer it. But through an intellectual light that he sent to me, that's infused knowledge, Jesus answered it himself. "And since it was through this infused knowledge and not words, I don't have the terms to express it. However, obedience wants me to try and see if I could manage to write something. I believe I'll only speak nonsense and I'll write things which do not really go together. But I place all my faith in obedience, especially since these are things that regard her directly." "And so I'm going to try," she says. It seemed to me that Jesus was saying, obedience is so glorified because she has the power of unveiling the human passions from their very roots. And right from the very beginning of our lives as well, it's wonderful to see children saying, one of the first things they say is, "No, no." They suddenly discover that they have a free will and they're not going to surrender to everything. So, obedience has the power of unveiling the human passions from their very roots. She, that is obedience, destroys in the soul everything which is earthly and material. That's why it's so costly to us. And to her great honour, she gives back to the soul her original state, that is, pre-fall. That is, the way she was created by God in her original justice before being cast out of the terrestrial Eden. So she's, obedience will bring you back to the state that Adam was in before the fall, which is quite incredible. And you understand, therefore, why Louisa was exercised so much in obedience. And in this sublime state, the soul feels strongly drawn to everything that is good. She feels all that is good, holy and perfect is inborn within herself, only when she goes back to that state, though. And this is very important for us because the Lord is trying to bring us all back to that original state to pick up from where Adam left off. And she feels the greatest horror at even the shadow of evil at this point. With this happy nature received from the most experienced hand of obedience, the soul no longer finds difficulty in executing commands received. More so, since the one who commands must always command what is good. Of course, that's the important thing. If someone commands you to do evil, of course, it's not the obedience we're talking about. We're talking about obedience that leads to the fullness of the divine will. And here is how obedience knows how to imprint well the divine image. Not only this, but she changes human nature into divine. So you can see why Louisa is being so severely exercised, because the Lord wants to bring her up onto this divine level where she will live in the divine will and not live down at the human level at all. He wants to make her the great eagle after himself. This is where obedience changes the human nature into divine, because just as God is good, holy and most perfect, he tends to all that is good and greatly hates evil, so does obedience have the power of divinizing human nature and of making it acquire the divine qualities. That's why the church, right from the very beginning of its history, had such a strong thing about men and women going into communities and taking vows of obedience and vows of poverty and vows of chastity to bring the church back to this original state. And the more the soul lets herself be handled by this most experienced hand, the more of the divine she acquires. Destroying her own being is what my book says. You can't destroy your own being, destroying her ego. And this is why she's so glorified and honoured. So much so that I myself submitted to her. That's I myself submitted to obedience. That's your John 14:31 again. And was honoured and glorified by this. And through her, I gave back honour and glory to all of my children, which they had lost through disobedience. Now, when you study the Old Testament deeply, you find that the whole thing is a struggle between the divine will and the human will, and that the Lord says to his people over and over and over again in book after book after book, I only asked you to listen to my word and to obey my word. I did not ask for all the sacrifices. I did not ask for all the stuff that you're doing. I only asked for obedience. So the last little paragraph here is, this is more or less what I've been able to manifest. The rest I feel inside of my mind, but I lack the words because the height and the concept of this virtue is such that my poor human language is unable to adapt itself. So she'll say more later on because she'll be forced to do it. November the 10th, 1900. This is about love and trust. And something which is desperately important for nowadays, and that is to trust God beyond reason. As Jesus continued not to come, Louisa said, I felt immersed in the greatest bitterness. My soul was tortured in a thousand ways. Then I felt as though a shadow was near me and I heard the voice of my adorable Jesus, though I couldn't see him, saying to me, the most perfect love is in the true trust that one must have in the loved object. To love somebody and not trust them is a contradiction in terms. We trust people that we truly love, and we love people that we truly trust. They're two sides of the one relationship. And if it should appear that the object one loves is lost, then more than ever is the time to prove this living trust. This is the easiest means to take possession of what one ardently loves. Having said this, both shadow and voice disappeared. And who could say the pain I felt in not having my beloved good? That's Psalm 63. So November the 11th, we're talking about going out of the divine will. And what are the results of going out of the divine will? It seems that the Blessed Lord wants to exercise me in patience. He has no compassion either for my tears or for my most sorrowful state. Without him, I see myself immersed in the greatest miseries. I believe that there's no soul more wicked than mine. Now, Louisa isn't actually telling the truth there. She just is associating her weakness and miseries with wickedness. Even though when I am with Jesus, I see myself bad more than ever. That's because the human and the divine have an infinite distance between the two. However, since I am with him who possesses all goods, my soul finds the remedy for all evils. But when I don't have him, everything is over for me. There's no more remedy for my miseries. And what is more, I am oppressed by the thought that my state is no longer his will. And not being in his will, I seem to be outside of the center. And many times I think of how to go out of this divine will. So, not being with these dispositions now, being with these dispositions, I felt Jesus behind my shoulder saying to me, you are tired, aren't you? And Louisa said, yes, Lord, I feel quite tired. And he continued, ah, my daughter, do not go out of my will, because by going out of my will, you come to lose the knowledge of me. That's extremely important. The more people move away from God's will, the less they understand him. The more they come into God's will, the more they understand him. And of course, not knowing me, you come to lose the knowledge of yourself. I need to give you Hosea 4:6 there. And that is that for lack of knowledge of God, the people perish. In fact, only in the reflections of the light one can distinguish with clarity whether there is gold or mud. That's Psalm 36, verse 9. Lord, only in your light can we actually see light. If everything is darkness, objects can easily be confused. Now, the light is my will, 1 John 1:5. This is a very important stage we've reached, because from here on in, the divine will simply be called the light. Okay, because God is light and the divine will is the essence of God. So the light is my will, which gives you the knowledge of me. And in the reflections of this light, you come to know who you are. We only come to know our sinfulness by looking at the holiness of God. We only can see our true selfishness by looking at the love of God. We can see our terrible injustices by looking at the justice of God, and so on and so on. Now, the light of my will, which gives you the knowledge of me, and in the reflections of this light, you come to know who you are. And in seeing your weakness, your pure nothingness, you cling to my arms, and united with me, you live with me in heaven. But if you want to go out of my will first, you will come to lose true humility, and then you will come to live on the earth. That means you become more earthy. And you would be forced to feel the earthly weight, to moan and to sigh like all the other unfortunates who live outside of my will. As Psalm 63, verse 8. And having said this, he withdrew without even letting himself be seen. And she said, "You can't imagine the torment of my soul." So November the 13th, 1900. Louisa sees the many human miseries, the degradation and stripping of the church, and the very degrading of priests. This is a very important message because it applies to now, to the crisis that's in the church. So I want to give you Isaiah 64:10 and Amos 3:7, the Lord speaking to the prophets ahead of time. After going through several days of most bitter privation, having received Holy Communion, I saw three children within my interior. Their beauty and equality was such that all three of them seemed to be born of the same labour. My soul was surprised and stupefied in seeing so much beauty enclosed in the circle of my miserable interior, and my stupefaction increased even more when I saw that these three children seemed to have many ropes of gold in their hands, and with these they bound themselves completely to me and my heart to them. Now, that brings you back to volume one, where she begins to see the Blessed Trinity and they begin to bind her to themselves. Then afterwards, as if one was taking his place, they began to discuss among themselves. As if each one was taking his place, they began to discuss among themselves. I couldn't understand, and I cannot find the words to repeat their most high language. I can only say that in the twinkling of an eye, I saw the many miseries, the degradation and stripping of the church, and the very degrading of priests, who, instead of being the light of people, are darkness. Okay. Now, like all prophecies, there's more than one layer there. For example, in the Soviet takeover in Russia, and the satellite states of Russia, the church was terribly degraded and there were millions of martyrs. So there's that aspect of it. But the second aspect of it is now with the apostasy that's in the church, that priests, instead of being a light, some of them are darkness. All embittered by this sight, I said, "Most holy God, give peace to the church. Let her be given back what they have taken away from her, and do not allow evil to laugh behind the back of the good." And as I was saying this, they said, "These are incomprehensible mysteries of God." And having said this, they disappeared. So I want to give you Romans 11, 33 to 36, and Isaiah 40, verse 13. So November 14, 1900, the Queen Mother refreshes Jesus and Louisa is taken to purgatory. "This morning on coming, my adorable Jesus transported me outside of myself and asked me for a refreshment for his pains." Now, the refreshment is suffering for the sake of souls and holding back divine justice. "Having nothing," I said, "most sweet love, if the Queen Mother was here, she could refresh you with her milk. But as for myself, I have nothing but miseries." That's John 15:5. "At that moment, the Most Holy Queen came, and immediately I said to her, 'Jesus feels the necessity of a refreshment. Give him some of your sweet milk, for he will be refreshed.' So our dearest mother gave him her milk, and my beloved Jesus was all refreshed. Then turning to me, he said, 'I feel cheered. You too, draw close to my lips and drink part of that milk which I received from my mother, so that we both may be refreshed.'" Now, you need to know that milk represents life, that you draw life from the other one. Okay, and when children put their mouths to their mother's breast, what they are actually doing is drawing life. They're not just drawing a liquid. So Louisa did this. But who can tell the power of that milk that came out boiling hot from Jesus? And he had so much of it that it seemed an immense fount, such that even if all men should drink of it, it wouldn't decrease anything. After this, we went round the earth a little, and at some place it seemed to be people sitting at a little table saying, there will be war in Europe. That is 1914 to 1918. Of course, as I say, there are different layers for these, so it might be the Second World War as well, 1939 to 45. And what is more sorrowful, it will be caused by relatives. Jesus was listening, but he didn't say anything on that regard, and therefore I do not know for sure whether there will be or not, since human judgments are mutable, and what they say today, they deny tomorrow. Then he transported me inside of a garden in which arose an immense building like a monastery, populated by so many people that it was difficult to count them. That's usually an image of the church, you see. At the sight of these people, my adorable Jesus turned his back on them. He clung against me, with all of himself, leaning his head on my shoulder, close to my neck. And he said to me, my beloved, don't let me see them. Otherwise, I would suffer greatly. That's the condition of the church today. So I too clasped him, Louisa said. And drawing near one of those souls, I said, tell me at least, who are you? And she answered, we are all purging souls. Okay. And our liberation is bound to the satisfaction of those pious legacies which we have left to our successors. And since they're not satisfied, we are forced to stay here away from our God. What pain this is for us. So, that great garden then that she sees is purgatory. It is the suffering church. and so what they're saying is that before they died, they left money for their relatives to offer masses and suffrage for them. And since the masses weren't offered, they are still in purgatory. We experience what pain this is for us, they said to her, because God becomes for us a necessary being whom we cannot do without, just as Louisa knows. We experience a continuous death which martyrs us in the most ruthless way. And if we do not die, it's because our soul is not subject to this. So sorrowful as we are, being without an object that forms our whole life, we implore God to make mortals experience a minimum of our pains by depriving them of what is necessary for the preservation of corporal life, that they may learn at their own expense how painful it is to be without what is absolutely necessary. Now, what you're saying here, reading there, is absolutely incredible. That because human beings will not do the suffrages for the souls in purgatory and get them relieved, the souls in purgatory then ask God to send us chastisement so that we will know what the pain of being without God is actually like. In other words, they send purgatory to the earth. Absolutely amazing. So after this, the Lord carried me somewhere else, and I, feeling compassion for these souls, said, how come, my good Jesus, that you turned your face away from these blessed souls who so much longed for you, while it would have been enough that you would let yourself be seen for those souls to be freed of the pains and be beatified? He said, oh, my daughter, if I had shown myself to them, since they are not completely purged, they could not have stood in my presence. And instead of flinging themselves into my arms confused, they would have drawn back, and I would have done nothing but increase their martyrdom and mine. This is why I did so. And having said that, he disappeared. So I want to give you Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So we'll stop there for this particular session.